Hey, everybody. Welcome to Movie Crush. Charles W. Chuck Bryant here for the last of my L.A. studio sessions. I had the wonderful Paul Scheer in to talk about Beverly Hills Cop. Big fan of Paul's, have long been a big fan of his from the early days on MTV with Human Giant. It's a very underrated show if you haven't seen Human Giant with Rob Hubel and Aziz Ansari and Paul Scheer. Go find that. And then later on with things like The League, very funny show, and one of my all-time favorite shows, Children's Hospital. Paul has been around, and we get into it with his early stories, which I just couldn't get enough of his early days in New York in the early formation of the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater and that whole crew that he was with back then, who all just went on to do great things. It's really amazing. Such a talented group of people who were just kids back then. And they're all doing really great, great stuff still. And Paul was great. And he came in here to talk about Beverly Hills Cop, but also to talk about his new podcast, Unspooled. So not only does he have the great bad, quote unquote, bad movie podcast, How Did This Get Made, with his lovely wife, June Diane Raphael, and Jason Mantzoukas, but he has a new show now called Unspooled, which takes a more more of a serious critical eye at the top 100 movies of all time. So it's kind of neat. He's clearly a huge, huge movie guy, and it was great to talk to him. I feel like we could have gone on for hours just talking about all kinds of movies, but check out Unspooled for sure on the Earwolf Network and Midroll. It's a really, really good show, and they're just getting cranking with it. So there's some really good stuff out there. I'm a big fan already. And here we go with Paul Scheer on Beverly Hills Cop. I want to talk about your podcast too, but let's go ahead and talk about your new show.
Yeah.
And the reason, because you've been making How Did This Get Made for a while now.
Yeah, it doesn't feel that long, but when I look at the dates, I'm like, wow, we've been doing it for a long, long time. We only do two new episodes a month. So we're almost at 200 episodes, but I think we've also been doing this since like 2011, I think.
I feel like it's been a while.
Yeah. So, you know, we put out fewer episodes than most, even though I do the mini episodes every single week. So I feel like I'm always living it. But I think it keeps it fresh for us, and it also doesn't keep it like a grind.
Yeah.
Which is good for all of us because Jason and June and myself, like we're all working actors and directors, writers, producers, you know, so we can, it's not our only job, which is, it's a good respite from everything else.
Yeah. I've tried to get Jason here a couple of times and he's hip to do it.
Right.
But just schedule hadn't worked out yet.
Yeah. He's right now in New York shooting John Wick 3.
Oh, no way.
As the TikTok man, which I am so, I mean, you can't get a better name. And I mean, come on, John Wick, the best.
That's great. But your new show, what was the impetus behind that? To do something a little more serious? I mean, not serious, but.
Well, it's interesting. The new show is called Unspooled, and I'm doing it with Amy Nicholson, who is a film critic that I really like. I was a fan of her show, and when we were developing some shows back in the day for Wolf Pop, I really liked her because she is critical without being pretentious. Uh-huh. She has opinions with but also her opinions aren't like she's conversationally opinionated, which is a nice thing to do, like not a shut you down type of person.
What was her background?
Her background is and this is where I'm a little bit hazy, you know, she wrote for the LA Times, she wrote for MTV.
Okay.
She writes Rolling Stone. Like, so she's all over the board. I like her reviews because they feel very much like a Pauline Kael review to me. They feel very full. And so I've always liked Amy. And we've done a couple episodes of her show. And it's always a blast. But this idea for Unspooled came up because there's this poster. It was like the 100 greatest movies of all time. Mm-hmm. And what you would do is you'd scratch one off.
I think I've seen that,
Yeah, as you watched it. And I looked at it. I was like, oh, I've seen a lot of these. Mm-hmm. And like all these lists, the Alamo Drafthouse best movies, the BMI list, like all these movies. I'm like, oh, I've seen these. And then you look at the list and you're like, well, I've seen a percentage of these. Mm-hmm. And then as I kind of thought about it even more, like, yeah, I've seen Taxi Driver. I don't remember Taxi Driver. Like,
right.
I remember the thing that you're supposed to remember, like the memeable moments
right.
from it. And I was like, oh, it'd be really fun to watch these movies. And especially now, in the sense that as I've now been creating stuff, watching bad movies, I'd love to see what people put forward as good, great, you know, seminal yeah. films. And so I was like, I want to do that. And I was like, well, why don't I do it as a podcast? Because uh-huh. it might be interesting to do it like that. And I partnered with Amy, and we are kind of just doing that, having a non-pretentious conversation, kind of what we'll have here today, I imagine,
yeah.
where we are just talking about film as people who love film, people
right.
who are interested in it. We hopefully will be a little bit educational, a little bit interesting, but it's really just, it's kind of like a very relaxed film class where you can mm-hmm. kind of check in and
that's
hopefully
what it feels like to me. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like to get people excited about watching movies, because for me, we've only, I think we're at this point, we've released about 4 or 5, but
yeah.
we've recorded about 10. I'm like, so kind of inspired by all mm-hmm. the stuff. And it's stuff that I've stayed away from. Like, yeah, like Citizen Kane. And I've talked to so many people who are like, yeah, I never saw it. And
right.
because it feels like homework. But then you realize it's not. It's good.
Yeah, it's a great movie.
And, you know, and we just did Swing Time, which is a Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers uh-huh. film. And I've never seen one. And there's a lot of debate about, does that belong on the AFI Top 100 list?
Yeah.
Top Hat might be better than Swing Time. Regardless of that,
yeah,
just to expose yourself to it uh-huh. is great. So I just find myself enjoying these movies. We watched French Connection a couple weeks ago.
So good.
Such a great movie. And it was a movie that I had watched.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing I remembered from it was they hid the drugs under, like, in the paneling.
Uh-huh.
Like, you know. But, and I'm like, how did I miss this entire movie? So in watching these movies that I hadn't seen or that I believed I saw,
yeah.
I'm like, oh, there's a whole other movie here
yeah.
that I've just, my brain is just kind of excised out. So I don't know. It really is coming from the joy of just watching stuff and wanting to talk about stuff. And we get to interview interesting people who
yeah.
are, you know, involved in some way.
Yeah. And that's even I've realized with this show, for movies that I've seen, I mean, some of these I've seen, I've recorded one on Raising Arizona yesterday. Yeah. I've seen that movie 25 times probably.
Right.
But there's something different when you watch it with a critical eye.
Yes.
And take notes and things jump out at you you never noticed. And to watch it more as a student of the movie has kind of been a fun experience. And I imagine you're kind of having that same thing.
Yeah. You are watching it without being forced to kind of watch it or,
mm-hmm.
you know, or you're watching it in the right situation. 2001 is a movie that I get. I
yeah.
understand why people like it. And my experiences in watching it were never really like, whoa, this movie blew my mind.
Yeah.
But for this podcast, I went to the Arclight Cinema out here in LA because
oh,
we're
nice.
Doing this like road show, the 70 millimeter.
Yeah.
And it blew my mind. I have not stopped thinking about that movie
uh-huh.
since I saw it. And I was like, oh, like now I get it. Yeah.
yeah.
But it's funny because it's like, I've, you know, that movie to me is a very like stoner film in the sense that like,
sure.
you know, people are like, watch this now and it's midnight and whatever you've been
uh-huh.
doing before. And it's like, that's not exactly the way that that movie should
yeah.
be enjoyed, or at least for the first time. And there's fun in, you know, we do it all the time with How Did This Get Made? We're critically looking at like, you know, a Mr. T movie or,
right.
you know, Hurricane Heist or whatever the thing is. So it is kind of refreshing for me just to be like, oh, every one of these movies is good. And
yeah.
now it's like a little bit of a debate of, does it belong there? Is it really good? And we were talking about this the other day. I don't know what you think about this, but like Platoon is like an interesting movie because
I just watched that last night for
oh, really?
One I'm recording tomorrow. Yeah.
So I watched that this week
mm-hmm.
and I found myself incredibly kind of like, wow, really moved by
yeah.
it. And especially the first half, like,
uh-huh.
You know, like up until, you know, kind of that famous moment with Willem Dafoe's character where he's kind of gunned down,
right?
You know, and then from there, the movie wasn't as like on the edge of my seat where
mm-hmm.
I was. But, you know, it's interesting. It's like, it doesn't mean it's a bad movie. Does it belong on that list? Is
yeah.
it better than Apocalypse Now? Does it have to be just compared to Vietnam movies? Like,
right.
But it's interesting.
It,
you know,
it won Best Picture.
Yeah.
You know,
and
I think I'd forgotten that.
Well, it's funny because we were talking about it in the sense that you, when you talk about Vietnam films,
mm-hmm.
Or at least for the longest time, it's Apocalypse Now and it's Deer Hunter. And
yeah.
very rarely is Platoon in like in that conversation.
I agree. Uh-huh.
But yet Platoon does something that I think no one ever did before, which was like kind of show Vietnam like the real way. It's a Vietnam
right.
vet who's like saying, I was there. This
uh-huh.
is what I saw. And so for that, I was like, whoa, this blows my mind. And that probably opened the door for a lot of filmmakers to make these movies that they've made about Iraq and PTSD and all this other stuff. But is, I don't know, what did you think at the end of the day? Because I'm curious, like, too, because I went in really emotionally attached to it. And then as I talked about it, I'm like, oh, well, I wonder where it all falls. Because, like, again, the first half is really fantastic to me. And then it just sort of, I don't know, it becomes more of a movie. Or like,
I mean, that's a movie I saw a lot in college. It was on our, with my roommates and I, it was on our VHS rotation for like a solid year. And it's the first time I'd seen it since. And I remember thinking back then, even like Oliver Stone is so heavy-handed.
Right.
With the voiceover, with the letters home to grandma and stuff. And I, that always has bugged me about him, even though I really enjoy some of his movies, how he will explicitly say, like, by the way, here's the theme of the movie, and I will literally tell it to you in a voiceover.
Yeah.
So I didn't feel like it needed that stuff. But I think what didn't hit me before was how much it was just a movie from the grunt's perspective.
Yeah.
And I don't know how often we had seen that at that point.
And showing, like, the factions within, like, I think at that point, probably you're not seeing, you're seeing like the greediness of war of the, you know, American soldiers fighting the enemy or the British, but you've never seen like the bad version of that. And that's interesting.
There were two murders of fellow soldiers.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And just the abuse of those people, like whether it's Charlie Sheen pointing that gun at, you know, the clearly mentally handicapped young man in the village and the raping of the those girls in the village. It's like, oh, this is an anti-American war film, which is interesting. Filmically, or as a film, it has this weird thing because you're saying, you're right, like the cut from a scene of guys like smoking marijuana to another scene of guys playing cards, listening to a song, basically saying, we don't smoke marijuana. Yeah. Like, you know, like that kind
of obvious.
Yeah.
God bless them.
Yeah. But it's interesting. But, you know, it's, and, you know, and that's a very 80s movie too. You know, it's like, this is the thing. 100 movies, shit gets in there.
Yeah.
Like, and we're talking about Swing Time. Like, Swing Time is a great example of, I've had more reaction to that episode than the others because people are like, that's not the best Rogers and Astaire movie. And why is it there?
Right.
Like, why is it there? Like, it's people like across the board are like, no, like Top Hat is way better than this.
That's interesting.
But it's because maybe the Library of Congress put it in. You know, it's like, so you all, you know, things slide in and then they're locked in. So I it's been an interesting discussion. None of them are bad films.
Yeah.
But it's sort of like, oh, we're just, you know, it's not like we're there to be like, let's take down this list. It's bullshit. I think it's more to be like, let's talk about these films and look at them in a way that's critical, but yet accessible.
Yeah. And I mean, lists like that are all just tough and problematic and subjective anyway.
Yeah.
But it's a cool way to tackle it for a podcast, I think.
Yeah. Well, thank you. You know, and I think the, what we're trying to struggle with too is talking about, and this is interesting. I'd love to hear your opinion about this. Like, where do you tackle a list that has 100 films on it? None of them directed by women.
Yeah.
You know, and that, like, that's
zero, huh?
Yeah, zero.
Yeah.
But yet you have, you know, and then you have like some people who have some very problematic things too. You have like a Roman Polanski and you have a Woody Allen, and it's
right.
like, and you have like Roman Polanski being kicked out of the Academy. Like, but now, and that doesn't mean that that movie is not valid. And I think a lot of people get very defensive about that. Like, well, like, cause there's blackface in Swing Time too. And it's like, well, that doesn't mean we can't watch it. It's like,
right.
But I think it's about like, well, if we are going to watch it, though, we have to have a discussion about context that we're watching these things in, because it's part of the dialogue now. It has to be.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I never really thought about that. Yeah. Boy, no women on that list. It's shocking, but also completely not surprising at all when you think about it.
So far, I have to say, like, also non-white representation is very minimal on that list so far. I mean, maybe we'll get into it, but on the 10 movies we've done.
Yeah.
It's nil. I mean, you know, it's
well, it's sort of an old school list.
Yeah. Well, 2007.
Is that when it came out?
Yeah. I mean, so, you know,
lots changed in the past 11 years.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, hopefully there'll be a new list, and hopefully that list will move things around, you know, and for the right ways. And I also believe it's like, let's bring in a movie that we hadn't been on the list that may have come out in 1950. Like, you know, like, you know, cause like Ben-Hur moved down to 100, but it was up in the 70s or 80s, like in the original list. So, I think it's interesting because you also don't want to put on like, you want to put Moonlight on that list now because it just came out. You need to have a little bit of distance to
for
be
sure.
like, how does it affect our culture?
Yep.
Because you don't want
the test of time.
Yeah. Uh-huh. You don't want it to be like the Academy Awards where it's very much like the flavor of the month and, and
crash.
Then it goes away. Exactly. Right. Yeah. And so it's an interesting list. I hope they come up with a new one.
Yeah. What I'm going to start doing is listening to your show and watching the movie beforehand, because I need someone to force my hand to watch a lot of these films because I'm getting to the age now. I'm 47 where I, you know, I'm not circling the drain, but I'm starting to think like I haven't seen fucking Casablanca.
Right. Yeah.
Like, I need to do that and not watch The Hangover again.
Well, we all have these movie holes, these like gaps in our, you know, it's like, and we all do, every single one of us. I mean, you know, and I feel like it's interesting to kind of follow them up. And also then when you see these movies, you go like, oh, like, you know, apropos to what we're talking about today, like watching French Connection, I was like, well, this is the genesis of the buddy cop. Uh-huh. Like, I mean, it's a different thing than what Lethal Weapon is, but you can see those seeds. And, and I think that's kind of fun for me as a movie fan that is, you know, more prone to watch, you know, John Wick or something like that. You know, it's fun to go like, oh, where did that come from?
Yeah, the genesis of these things.
Yeah.
That's cool.
I just watched Hotel Artemis the other night. And
what's that?
Hotel Artemis is a new movie that just came out, directed by Drew Pearce and written by Drew Pearce. And this is a guy who kind of came up in British comedy circle, then got into writing like these big giant action movies. He wrote Iron Man 3 and did the story for Mission Impossible. And it's just kind of been attached to big projects. And he wrote a script, got on the blacklist, and then made this little indie movie. It stars Jodie Foster and Sterling K. Brown and Brian Tyree Henry and just a Jeff Goldblum, an assortment of cool people. And what got me really excited about it was it's an indie movie that felt like the indie movies that were being made in the 90s, like by like Miramax, like, you know, like you would see like Quentin Tarantino being like, we support this person. And you know, or it felt like what Dusk Till Dawn felt like, you know, like, it's not for everybody. It's kind of like an elevated B movie that's cool and weird. And it's like, I was saying, it's like Repo Man meets Barton Fink, you know, it's like this kind of, you know, and it's like, that to me is so exciting because I feel like indie film now has become, like very mumblecore-y kind of stuff. And it's so nice to kind of get out of that. You know, it's genre, which is horror and mumblecore. And it's like, oh, I want to see like the action.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, and I think like, and the appreciation for all that, like, I, like you see that movie, you're like, oh, that reminds me of Repo Man. I want to watch Repo Man again. I want to watch Barton Fink again. I think like, hopefully we fuel each other and be like, oh, if you see Casablanca, you'd be like, oh, now I appreciate this other movie for that. And I don't know. It kind of opens up a conversation within yourself.
Yeah. Because I mean, how many stories are there? What do they say?
Yeah. It's like four stories, right? Or something like so small like that.
And everything is a variation on those themes. Yeah. So, that's really cool. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Long Island, right outside of New York City.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, typical suburban life. Nothing too exciting. I feel like as I've gotten older, you know, I moved to New York to go to NYU.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely more sheltered in my community, which I imagine most people are, you know? And that was, you know, but my gateway out was my parents were divorced and my dad was a very integral in like kind of getting me to see cool things. Like he would tape Saturday Night Live for me before I was old enough to stay awake for it. And then we'd watch it on Sunday mornings.
Oh, that's great.
You know, and he would, he had two VCRs and we'd tape stuff. And one of the movie we're going to talk about today, like he would tape it and cut out like the nudity.
Right.
You know, so I could see it and the violence in the beginning. Like, but like he knew like I liked certain stuff and he like exposed me to it. And that was like a really, for me, such a cool thing to kind of feel like that was my gateway to kind of finding stuff. I didn't have brothers and sisters and, and the people I was growing up with like normal stuff, but I was definitely a latchkey kid who watched a lot of TV, a lot of movies and, you know, kind of was pulling all this stuff in. So my dad really kind of supported that.
Was your, did you have any ideas that you could be an actor and a writer or did that seem accessible at all to you?
You know, yes and no. I feel like in the beginning when you're youthful, you go, yeah, like that's what I want to do. And then it just seemed to me by the time I went to college, because I was in like plays and I was writing things in school. And like one of my senior plays, like I wrote all the middle stuff, like basically a stand-up comedy routine in between all these musical numbers. And I was like, I want to do this. But then my parents are like, you have to go to college. You got to get it, you know? And so I went to college. I went there to study education, teaching, whatever. And I fell in line with this like Upright Citizens Brigade Theater, which is an improv theater that was doing like kind of improv, like every time this bell rings, ding, you know, you have to change the last thing that you said.
Those are the early days of UCB too, I guess.
Well, this is, yeah, this is Chicago ceiling. It's even pre-UCB. They weren't even there. And so we were doing like, I was doing like, not shitty improv, but very basic short form improv. And everyone there, if they didn't have day jobs, they were, they weren't even like, I want to audition for movies and I want to audition for commercials. They, there was this sort of like a workaday element to it. And it just felt like, oh, the best thing I could ever achieve is to get into the main stage of this company. And that will be that. And then UCB came to town. And UCB is the Upright Citizens Brigade, kind of this punk rock comedy thing. You know, five floors above a hardware store when I first started seeing them. And they blew my mind. One suggestion, and they're doing these crazy improv sets. And this is what was going on in Chicago, but we didn't feel it in New York. And there was so much buzz around them. And there were celebrities playing with them. And when I was watching them, celebrities that you know now were all playing with. It was Adam McKay and Tina Fey and Brian Stack and Miriam Tolenstack. Like all these people that you would – that you've seen in a million things, Rachel Dratch. But they were just playing on Sunday, you know, and they've all grown to become – but celebrities were in the audience and you felt cool as a $5 ticket. And you every Sunday night you go watch this show. And I was so like, I need to get in here. And I got in, and that's when my world kind of opened. And it was like, oh, this is attainable. This is actually something I could do. Like,
yeah, you were good at it.
Yeah, it was like good at it, and that it could be a career because like the UCB were creating their own shows. People I was going out with, not going out with, but like people I was peers with were auditioning for commercials in Chicago. You know, they weren't, you just felt like, oh, this is alive. And then, you know, SNL came to UCB and I got to be in that show and got to audition for SNL a handful of times. Like just like opportunities were coming from being associated with this thing. So it didn't, it was kind of a multi-step process. Like it was, you know, resigned going to college and going like, well, I won't ever do this because my parents won't pay for that. And you know, it's so hard. And then I got into this one thing. I was like, well, this will be where I am. And I'm happy with that. It's cool. And then it was like, whoa, no, this, you know, I attribute everything good in my creative life and even my personal life to UCB because that's where I met my wife.
Yeah. Well, who was in your, who was in that crew, in your early crew?
My early crew was people like Rob Riggle, you know, from The Hangover and The Daily Show. Rob Corddry, also from The Daily Show. I'm trying to think of Rob.
Big Human Giant fan, by the way.
Oh, thanks so much. Yeah. Yeah.
That was
Rob,
so great.
Oh, that was so, just a fun show to do. Rob Hubel, Nick Kroll, John Mulaney. Like, you know, it's kind of like it's kind of everybody that is in comedy.
Yeah,
like, you know,
it's
like
crazy. And you were just kids.
Exactly. We all came to New York. You know, like I went to I went to Georgetown because my friend Owen Burke, who runs Gary Sanchez, Adam McKay's company, like he was like, I want to go back to my school. That's where I met Kroll and John Mulaney.
Oh, really?
You know, they were like a couple of years younger than us. And then, you know, you just kind of paired up with people. So the original group that we were, we're actually all going back to New York for the Del Close Marathon, which is a sick thing. And we're putting together one of the original groups.
Oh, fun.
You know, but yeah, it's all these people who've had tremendous success, whether it's Scott Armstrong, who wrote, you know, Old School and Elf, you know, it's directors, it's writers, Peyton Reed,
crazy.
You know, was directing UCB and hanging out. And
was he?
Yeah.
Like, oh, interesting.
Yeah, he directed the show. And it was one of my, I think my first speaking line parts was, and I love Peyton Reed because he directed Mr. Show. And I was like, now he's directing UCB. And, you know, so you just... But these are all of our friends. We were all doing extra work for 14 hours a day on a UCB show. But it was all these people now that have achieved something, you know, from Chris Gethard to, you know, all across the board.
It's crazy, man. I mean, there was so much talent. It feels like, I mean, for a guy like me who were fans of all you guys, like it seems like everybody went on to do great things.
Well, you know what? I think that the UCB... instilled in all of us this idea of throwing the ladder back down, right? Like, you know, so
that's great.
When they were on Conan and they were getting more successful, they were like, well, just take all of our students, you know? So then all of a sudden we're starting to do Conan. And then, you know, when we got our opportunities, we would go like, well, who else is around? Like, if you look at the Human Giant 24-hour marathon where we took over MTV for 24 hours, if you look at those faces in that group, everyone that we brought there, they're all of our friends, and each one of them is doing something very interesting and creative. But it was like, it's because they are – that was it. That's who we drew from. We weren't stand-ups. We were – this is a community. And at that point, it was probably a community of like a couple hundred people. And so it was like, well, when we wanted to cast somebody funny, we had – the perfect casting pool right there, you know? So that's, you know, I think the reason why you see a lot of cross-pollination. If you look at NTSF, SDSUV, which is a show I did for Adult Swim and Children's Hospital, everybody there. You look at Human Giant, that's everybody there. We are very often just using people. And to this day, you know, it's like, who do I get in that are my friends? And sometimes you have to be like, who do I try to get in? I have to kind of break myself of that mold, you know, like, because it's sort of like I can kind of sometimes get so cut off. But what I've been trying to do, like when I did the show Drive Share last year with Hubel, we just like pulled like the best and the brightest from like UCB LA. And I met so many amazing people, so many funny people.
Oh, that's great. Cause I was kind of wondering about that. It seems like, I mean, UCB has now become an institution. Which is great, but there are so many people cycling through there that are super talented, but it's like, it's not like the old days.
No, the old days, like you could go to a party, a UCB party, you knew everybody,
right?
Everyone knew you. And now you go to a UCB party and you would have maybe 1/4 of the UCB, like, you know, it's like we could all fit in a space at one point. Now it's just not that. It's not that at all. You know?
I imagine you guys are just like gods to these kids out here
You know what I would say? I would say I don't even think they know us, honestly.
What? Like,
you know, because I think they probably know that we do stuff, but not because of UCB. They have their own people that they came up, like we had our people that we looked up to, and then they had, and we had people below us that looked up to, you know, you're always looking to the people ahead. And I think that, yes, we're there and we've done stuff, and I still do an improv show there. And but I feel like the cool thing about UCB is it doesn't stand on history. It's like, what are we doing? And that may be the same attitude that we had, which is a very punk rock attitude. It's like, all right, the UCB, how can we best the UCB? Like, we want to be as good or if not better. And then people would watch us and be like, I want to be like this. And you know, you had these factions even within UCB early on, and like polite factions. There were like, you know, we were all friends, but it was sort of like, I was on a group called Respecto. It was like me, Jack McBrayer, Rob Riggle, Rob Hubel, you know, a handful of other people. And then there was another group called The Swarm. And that was like people like Andy Daly and Andrew Secundum, people like that. And the Swarm took a very slow style of improvising, which was an element of UCB and the four. And then we took the fast style of it.
Yeah.
And then there were people who came after us and they're like, oh, we're going to go more Respecto. We're going to go more Swarm. And then there was just like everyone just kept on building off of each other. So, you know, we were following something and they were copying us and they became something. So it, in a cool way, everyone's kind of morphing on a new thing. So you don't even get to look that far down the line because I think UCB doesn't install pillars. There's not like a wall like at the Groundlings or like these are the people who came before you and these are the Groundlings.
It's right.
Like you're just the next crew and that's it.
Yeah,
and,
you know, that's kind of cool, I guess.
Which is kind of – I like it in the sense that you can define yourself in your own way. That's why even in our show that we do now, I play with people – that are younger and came up in a way different time than us. Just like, oh yeah, well we play similarly and you play good with us, you know, so that's it.
What are you doing now at UCB? What show
is it? It's called Facebook, which is a show that we started when UCB opened in LA, which I think now is over like 12 years ago. But the idea of it is we take a look at somebody's Facebook profile and then we improvise scenes based on it. And the reason why we
just a random person?
Random
that
person
hasn't opened.
Yeah, so they have to sign in and get on there. The reason why we started it, it was started off actually as MySpace, so that's how long we've been doing it. But Because people didn't believe improv out here. Uh-huh. We would do a show in New York. We could take one suggestion. We can go for an hour.
Yeah.
And no one would doubt it. Here, we had to kind of spoon feed improv right in the beginning. We had to be
what
like,
do you mean believe? They thought that you had written, pre... Oh,
yeah. And, like, and you know, and we encountered that every now and then in New York. Some people are like, well, you write that. Well, you write that. And you know what you're going to do. It's like, no, we're improvising. That's right. What we're doing. That's what we... Well, no, you couldn't have done that. And it's like... No, that's what we do. We had a Saturday at 10 show, and a handful of times people would like want their money back because they were told they were seeing improv.
They'd want their $5
yeah,
back.
Yeah, exactly. And we're like, it's improv. Like, but it's a funny thing because then you would tell people we improvise, and then people are like, well, yeah, but how much?
Right.
The whole thing. Uh-huh. And believe me, we've done some more than our share of bad shows. We improvise. Like, yeah. You know, yeah. But I think we always joke that our improv is at the level where when we think we're having a bad show, it's still entertaining to an audience, which has taken a while to get, you know, to yeah. get there. All that to be said, it was just sort of like we were coming out to LA. They didn't really have an improv scene. Uh-huh. They had the Groundlings. Second City had a very little footprint here. So we had to show them like what we're doing is improvising. Mm-hmm. Like, we're going to bring a random person up from the audience. Mm-hmm. There's no plan. And people still think we have plants, which is
right.
crazy. Bring a person up from the audience. We watch them log in to their computer. We get on there and we start talking uh-huh. to them. And then we interview them for about 5-7 minutes. And then we improvise 15-20 minutes of scenes. And we try to tie those scenes to what we've gotten yeah. out of there. So it just basically, it's like a magic trick revealed. It's like, here it is. You're wondering why yeah. we're in a dentist's office. Well, this guy said he is a dentist. Like, you know,
right.
like, so we're trying to like draw those lines. And we felt like that was really beneficial because it lets the audience in and it's like, oh, that's what they can kind of play along with you. It's yeah. like, oh, good. You know, like they're playing a bingo in a way. And not to say anything bad about LA audiences, but we wanted to develop a form mm-hmm. that wasn't just give us a suggestion and let's go. We,
right.
You know, so that was our mentality.
Yeah. I mean, that's the ultimate compliment though. Like if those people that say that, like, he's a plant or you guys right. really write this, right?
Yeah.
They need to see bad improv.
Right.
Because there is bad improv.
Yeah.
And I don't want to like knock people. It's people that are probably working on their stuff.
As was I for many years too. And I mean, still.
Yeah. But yeah. when you see like you guys or, I'm a big fan of, the Convoy guys.
Oh yeah. Those guys are great.
Yeah. Or Super Ego. And they're just yeah. like, they're so tight and it's like a musical group. You know, when you work with each other, it probably does feel written if you're uninitiated as some, you know, as an audience member.
Well, I think people always say that about The League. Like people are always surprised. The show I did, The League on FX. Like
such a great show.
Oh, thanks. That was an improvised show. There was no script. It was Curb style. Like,
really?
You know, yeah. We just had,
I knew that.
Yeah. We had a 12-page outline. Uh-huh. So, and I wrote a handful of those episodes. It was really hard to write because you have
You're
to
used
write
to scripting probably.
Yeah. And you have to write, a scene that lets you know what you need to hit mm-hmm. for the plot
yeah.
and give you ideas where you can be funny, but also we can get away from it. Like some of the best stuff in that show and was things that we found in the moment, mm-hmm. you know, and it's not like one take and we're done. We're not doing like a Woody Harrelson Lost in London kind of thing. You know,
right.
we're doing it like, oh, that was a funny bit about the corn. Like, let's do that again. And I'll say that to set you up and great, we'll take two. And uh-huh. So you're almost like, doing like three takes of a scene. And by the time you get the third take, it's a crafted thing, but it right. all was developed out of this improvised. The cameras are running and we're using yeah. that and we're just refining it, you know? And like, and that was one of the great things about our creators, Jeff and Jackie, that uh-huh. they were able to, you know, just corral that and, yeah. and kind of put, you know, put us in there and use stuff that we improvise would become integral to the show and, uh-huh. and our characters. Yeah. It was great.
I love that show, man. There was every time I tried to turn someone on to it,
yeah.
I would have to explain to them that it was not about fantasy football.
Yes.
That was sort of a framework, I guess. But, and you know, if you were also into fantasy football, there were great little things peppered in there.
100%, yeah.
But you certainly did not have to be a fan of football at all to love that show.
Well, that was our struggle all along. And I think as the show grew, especially once it got on Netflix, people got more hip to it, especially uh-huh. Women. And I found yeah. like, a lot of the show was marketed to like dudes. And
yeah.
in all the advertising campaign were like footballs and ref whistles uh-huh. and, you know, and the sports announcer. And I
slightly misleading.
Yeah, we'd always argue like, no, this is really about people in their 30s mm-hmm. just trying to be adults. Yeah. Some have kids, some are single, some are divorced.
Right.
And yes, they're the reason why they get together. They're, you know, you don't have to hang out in a bar to like Cheers. You don't have to like, you know, you don't have to be a genius to like watch Big Bang Theory. It's,
right.
It's like we've just given them a reason to exist together.
Yeah.
And
to fuck with each other and
yeah. and so as the show kind of went on, we found like that was a really cool thing. And we so many people are like, I don't watch fantasy football, but I love the show. I'm like, great. You don't need to. Like our plots were very rarely the reason I didn't audition for the show was because I was like, I can't improvise about fantasy football. And mm-hmm. it's not about fantasy football.
Yeah.
And so I almost missed an opportunity to do that show simply because man. I was like, I would feel uncomfortable, like, you know, talking about LaVon Bell or, you know, like, I can't improvise in that.
Yeah.
Thing. Like, you don't have to. And then that was the benefit of it.
If you'll indulge me a minute for Children's Hospital, too.
Oh, yeah.
One of my favorite shows. And it was just so it's kind of one of my favorite kinds of comedy that I always describe to my wife as silly or dumb.
Yeah.
But I mean that in the best way.
Yeah.
Like dumb jokes to me can be an absurdist, maybe is a better word.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that if you look at like, you know, Rob Corddry created that show with David Wayne. And David Wayne, when you look at Wet Hot American Summer.
Oh, sure.
You know, has that streak. And I think that they both kind of worked so well together and set a tone so early on that – they just kind of nailed this thing. So when I've written episodes of that and I was on that show and you knew exactly what they wanted, but they were also the arbiters of this, the final say. And, and Rob, you know, really, really had that tone and voice down. And you're right. It's silly. It's dumb. It's weird. It's
so funny. It was so strange.
Yeah. It's just a bizarre, great show. And, and you know, I think really helped Adult Swim kind of put itself on its on the map as far as doing live action that was interesting and different. You know, before that, I think they were taking a lot of shots and none of them worked. And then we got to kind of, jump in their kind of wake and get to do NTSF, which was, again, like kind of silly and a parody and fun and, you know, get to do all this sort of fun stuff. But before that, there is no outlet to kind of do it. So Children's kind of really blew out that path.
Yeah. I mean, I think everyone of sort of our age group grew up loving like the airplane movies and stuff like Naked Gun. And it had been a long time. Like that kind of parody sort of went out of fashion.
Right.
And I think Children's Hospital
we talk
kind
about,
of picked that up a little bit.
We talk about that a lot. We were always saying that like the thing about Naked Gun and Airplane was that they were funny movies that had big, crazy jokes in them, right?
Yeah.
But it wasn't like the Wayans Brothers movies, which are so referential that like the way that you get the joke is because you saw Borat, so you know that's that joke, or you saw The Happening. So, and no offense to that style of comedy, but we definitely went into the parody version of it instead of like, and I don't know if it maybe the better word is satire, but you know what, I love Police Squad and I loved, you know, Airplane, but you didn't need to know anything more than
absolutely
the trope of it's a cop show, it's a plane thing, and we're in.
Yeah.
And so that was something we always tried to do is like, no, we need to create real characters, real stakes, real things, and do jokes around them.
Yeah. And there was something about it was sort of a stroke of genius, I think, to hit on that 15-minute length. It was
great. You never get tired of it
because
it literally was 11 minutes and 12 seconds of material.
Yeah.
And
you got a lot done in that 11 minutes, so it's crazy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I found it actually, it's been hard to transition into larger
22
scripts.
Minutes.
Yeah. When you are used to being so, you're executing in, you know, 11 pages, an A, B, and C plot.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, challenge and all that great stuff, you know, it's fun.
That's great. All right. So I guess we should get into Beverly Hills Cop.
Yeah.
This was your pick, which I think did you have another pick too that you were debating? Was this the one? I felt like.
I remember that when you asked me about it, I may have submitted two, but I don't remember the other one.
I don't either.
I've been in this new phase, which has been not trying to be cool about what I like, because like there's like a thing that was going on with Filmstruck. And it was like, you're Filmstruck 4, what are you? And everyone would be like, well, I'm part, you know, Before Sunrise, but also part, Avengers, but also part this. And I'm like, and you could tell that everyone was trying to like check every box.
Yeah, sure.
And for me, and I'm not saying that everyone has to be this, but I was a kid of the 80s. And for me, my Filmstruck 4 kind of opened my eyes, because I'm like, well, no, I am Back to the Future, Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah, Die Hard.
Die Hard. Yeah, like those are the movies that I've watched the most, that I don't know if they have defined me, but they are me. Like, you know, it's like, and I could only judge it by the movies I've watched the most times. And those are the movies I've watched the most times. I've watched Raiders of the Lost Ark, Die Hard, Back to the Future, and, you know, these movies. Yeah. And Beverly Hills Cop is like a close fifth, and probably even maybe even gets into that four occasionally, because it's like movies I love that I grew up on that I didn't have any. I wasn't trying to be cool. It's like, I like this, and I'm going to watch it into the ground.
Right. 1984, I was 13. The great Martin Brest, who Midnight Run is one of my all-time favorite movies.
Absolutely. Midnight Run, to me, is a perfect, perfect film. Yeah. And another movie that doesn't get that much credit, and Martin Brest made these two kind of very interesting movies, and, you know, again, you get in this like thing where you're like, oh yeah, Midnight Run, I could talk about that forever. Yeah, it's so good.
Yeah, I mean, Midnight Run is one of those where I cannot not watch it if I happen upon it.
It's such a great film. You know, I say about Martin Brest too, it's interesting because he also is the guy behind Geely, which is
Well, that's what killed his career, I think.
And it's such a bummer because he also was behind these two, you know, more than two seminal work. I mean, you know, and what I'm always impressed with this movie in particular is, you know, the whole story behind it was that, like, Sylvester Stallone was supposed to do this movie.
Yeah, I read a little bit about that, is crazy to think about.
Oh, yeah. And so I think that the character name, it was Axel Cobra or Cobretti, Axel Cobretti.
Axel Cobretti.
So he took the Cobretti, brought it over to Cobra, and maybe some elements from Beverly Hills Cop brought that over. And then
so funny.
This movie just was kind of laying in waste. And Eddie Murphy had this opening at SNL, and it was like, can we get this thing going? And it was one of those, let's slot him in and let's do this really quick. And they did. And I think it's one of the reasons why I like this movie and why I kind of wanted to talk about it, because it shows that you can make a good cop movie without having to play up the comedy. You cast a funny person to make the funny stuff funny. But it's like, if you were to make this today, you would have a lot of funny set pieces.
Absolutely.
You don't have funny set pieces. You have cop set pieces in this. And there's a difference. And I think that's why these movies, or this movie in particular, really works. It's like Eddie Murphy is just like, poof, just exploding with, you know, kind of charm. And, you know,
this is like peak Eddie Murphy, probably.
It is like post 48 Hours, kind of coming into his own. He's a little bit older, but not that much.
Yeah.
And he carries this movie on his shoulders, but you kind of just feel like, I don't know, you don't see that transition a lot. I think you see movies that cater towards, you know, that cater towards the comedy. It's like, well, it's a comedy. It's, and, you know, that's why I think, I don't know, it's, there's something about it that I was like, oh, I love that. If they would have developed it for a year, would it have been as good?
Right. Yeah, totally. And he was, and this is Eddie Murphy. There's been a few times in like the modern era where you can kind of clearly say, like, this is the funniest person on the planet right now. And Eddie Murphy owned that title for a while.
Oh, 100%. I mean, it's crazy to think that kids now, or people now, I should say, they aren't kids anymore, don't know him as a comedian. They know him as like a Disney Dr. Dolittle kind of guy. And it's like,
crazy.
I would give anything to see Eddie Murphy like back doing something just, I don't need him to be like holding the gun and running around, but just creatively fulfilling. Like, there is a pilot that I got to watch. It was the Beverly Hills Cop TV show pilot that was done by Sean Ryan, I believe. And Eddie Murphy is in it as Axel Foley. The show is about his son. And no offense to anyone in that movie or that TV show, but when Eddie Murphy comes on as Axel Foley.
So this is recent?
This is like about 2 years ago.
Oh, wow.
He runs circles around everyone. It's so exciting to see him just kill this character. The one thing that's funny about it, in my opinion, is that there's a little bit more Eddie Murphy and Axel than in that version, because Axel's dressed real nice.
Yeah, sure.
You know, he's Mumford
Fizzhead shirt.
No, he looks like Eddie Murphy, kind of like the Metro version of Eddie Murphy, that movie that he did with De Niro, but the energy is there. Uh-huh. It's the right, he's doing everything right. And all I could think of is the reason why this pilot didn't go is because you watch it and you go, all I want to see is more Eddie Murphy.
Yeah.
Like, I want to see him do the show.
And he was just sort of a side setup character.
He was the dad, and he would be in a handful of episodes. Gotcha. Judge Reinhold was going to be like the main guy. I think he'd become like the mayor of Beverly Hills.
Of course.
You know, right? Or the police commissioner. He had he was like the big reveal at the end. But yeah, you know, and Eddie Murphy to me is, you know, Beverly Hills Cop 2 and all these movies. Just, he was my guy. And I love Bill Murray and I love Steve Martin. But there was something about those guys feeling like those are my dad's guys. Eddie Murphy felt like my guy.
Yeah.
And when I was growing up, we're roughly, you know, in the same age, you know, range.
Yeah, right? And Delirious and Raw, like, I could quote those by heart as a kid. Like, some of the funniest stand-up I've ever seen. And, like, I don't want to knock Eddie Murphy now, but it's just so hard to see someone that was the funniest person on the planet kind of not be that anymore.
Well, you know what I think it is like, I feel like Eddie has all of it at his disposal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like, it's crazy because you look, The Nutty Professor, I watched that recently again. I'm like, whoa, this movie is fucking hilarious. Like, he kills that movie. And I think at a certain point, he's just knocking out franchise, like the biggest movie star.
Right.
And then I don't think he's getting lazy because he's always good in it, but you may surround yourself. You may make
that everyone's
are a
saying yes, Eddie.
And I don't think that he's, or everybody I've spoken to when they talked about Eddie Murphy and they've dealt with Eddie Murphy is like, mentally, he is with it. He knows what is good. He mm-hmm. knows what is solid. But I think in his mind, he's like, I will do these kid movies that mm-hmm. pay me. I'm getting $20 million
sure.
like twice a year,
yeah.
making $40 million. And they're going to do great.
Yeah.
I don't even have to worry about even promoting them. It's like the Adam Sandler model. If Adam Sandler went to go do kids movies, uh-huh. instead, you know, I don't know. But you watch him in Dreamgirls and you're like, he's got it. He's got it all. Like, he's always got it. It just like, but not always in the right thing. Like I said, in that Beverly Hills Cop TV pilot, I was like, well, it's still there. It's not like, and there's so many people we can point to that were at the height, and not to call names, but like Chevy Chase.
Sure.
Hilariously funny guy. Once at the top of his game, one of the funniest people in America. He doesn't got it. Like, I don't think he, I think when he gets it, it's a hit or miss.
Uh-huh.
Eddie Murphy is like, great, put me in the right thing and I'll just kill this for you.
Yeah, and as an amateur psychologist, I always see Eddie Murphy and think, man, what he needs to do is do an hour of stand-up again.
Right.
And kind of go back to his roots and challenge himself.
Yeah. But why challenge yourself when you are that rich?
But how many millions does he need? Like, he's there.
Well, that's why I think he's kind of retired. I mean, he hasn't really made a movie in 5 or 6 years. I mean, he pops up in that movie, like that little drama film about the piano player. Like, but it's like, he's not trying to do anything. Like, after Norbit.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's a calculated play where he's like, okay, I need to disappear.
Mm-hmm.
So when I come back, I'll be Eddie Murphy. I can't just be like Norbit and Dreamgirls in the same year.
Right.
Because it wrecks the brand, you know?
Yeah, and that's a big risk. I mean, it's easy for me to say, hey, go back up and do stand-up again and challenge yourself. But, like, there's a lot at stake there because if it's not there, then that tarnishes the brand.
Well, it also is a different era because, you know, Eddie didn't always write his own stand-up, you know, especially when you talk about, like, Delirious. Like, there's a lot of writers there, you know?
Oh,
like,
really?
Like Keenan
I don't
Ivory,
think I ever looked at the credits.
Oh, yeah. Like, Keenan Ivory Wayans is, like, a writer for Eddie Murphy. Yeah, like, I mean, they're credited, so it's not even a hidden thing. I feel like, and look, I think you talk to people like Judd Apatow and Kevin Hart and all these people, like, when you get to a certain level and you are working with people, and it's like, here's a genesis. So how about this or how about that? You know, people help. I've always heard that, you know, like, cause it's, I think when you get to a level of celebrity that's so big, you can't just like work out at the clubs. Like your obligations preclude you from doing that, you know? And Kevin Hart is the only example I can look at who's some guy who like hustles out at the club, and Patton Oswalt like gets out at the club, but Patton's not getting out 5 nights a week. Patton's getting, we talked about this. I did his FYC, you know, he's getting out like once a month, a big show at Largo, and once a week, at, like, clubs around. Do you need somebody to be like, hey, what about that? Maybe this, you know, it's good.
Yeah. So I had a Mumford Phys Ed shirt when I was in high school.
I got one in my closet right now.
It was a big deal. This movie's a big deal to me. And it was cool seeing it as an adult now, because so many things jump out at me, like what a good acting performance he gives. Comedy aside, there's some like legit good acting in this movie.
Yeah. His friend gets killed. I mean, the opening.
And you believe all that stuff.
100%. Like, there's something so interesting about how gritty the movie is when it opens. Like, you're hearing a Glenn Frey, the heat is on, and you're going through, you know, Detroit. Mm-hmm. At a period of time where Detroit is, I mean, look, I don't think Detroit's that much better right now, but, but you know, you're capturing this vibe and you, from the moment you get in and you hear those things, you're like, oh, this is different. Like, this is not glossy. And I think it does a great contrast to Beverly Hills,
sure.
but you're seeing this world and he fits so perfect. It doesn't feel like a movie star in Detroit. Like when he's getting balled out by the police chief.
Oh, he's so great.
He's great. Actual police chief, that guy.
I think I knew that. He says, fuck, I don't know, something like,
don't think it makes my dick itch. That's a great line.
He has some of the best over the top lines.
It's amazing. But when he's in that, like, it's the only time too I've seen like a cop, like a precinct that looked like a precinct, like all those cops, like in, it's like a communal, like kind of gym locker room.
Yeah.
Like everything about it feels real tangible and real. And the fact that he's friends with this like former criminal who's coming back and stealing these bearer bonds. Like, I don't know. You're right. It just feels. It doesn't feel like he's winking at it. It doesn't feel like he's above it. It feels like he's a part of this landscape. And when he goes to Beverly Hills, I think that's why it works so good.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't feel – he feels like the outcast. And if you were to make a big argument on Beverly Hills Cop 2, which I also love, he's worked the system. He's in the system. He doesn't feel daunted by the system. Where here, you feel like it has those elements of like, here's a black man walking around Beverly Hills. Why is he there? And they like basically pick him up. You know, like he's getting harassed. You know, he's a black guy in Beverly Hills, and the movie is about race. It is. It's out there in the front line, and it's like, oh, that's cool too that they're playing that. Like it's
especially they don't for 1984.
Yeah, they're not shying away from that. Yeah. I think that's kind of
Yeah, and I love his relationship with, with both Mikey and the what was it, Jenny?
Jenny, who is great, and like one of those. I don't know, you probably even doing this podcast, like see all these actresses that kind of disappear, like these
leading actresses. Face.
Yeah. And it's like, well, they just do like one or two movies and then they're gone.
Yeah.
And it's such a bizarre world that we lived in the 80s where it was like, you are a leading lady and it disappeared. Like, you know, like very rarely is there the Gina Davis and Fletch that goes on to be like Gina Davis.
Right.
Like, you know, it's.
Yeah, that's true.
You know,
that's a good point. But you really believe that the nature of their relationship, like he and Mikey at the beginning when he tells him he loves him. And
those are some
pretty like profound for this movie, profound moments.
And you don't see it in a movie like this. Like you would never see like Mikey's all drunk and he's kind of holding him by his head. And sets up the whole idea, which is like he took the hit for Axel. Like he stole a car. He went to jail. Axel didn't. And Axel's now a cop and Mikey is... You know, not
still,
still kind of. And so, but it just shows you like also economy. It's like you get it all. You get these guys, you get like, you don't feel like he's like threatening him. Like, I took this hit for you. You did it. He's drunkenly kind of telling him like, oh, I remember that. Like, you know, and there's a real like, that guy who plays Mikey is actually very good.
Yeah.
Like,
he's really good.
They had great sleaze bags in the 80s. Midnight Run is another great, you know, like you could smell these guys. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, the great John Ashton from both Midnight Run in this. He's so good in this.
And, you know, how versatile John Ashton is. Because John Ashton is one way in this movie and another way in Midnight Run.
Yeah.
And there, you don't even realize, like, you're like, oh, he's a good, just a solid actor. Like, you just do it because it's fully different performances. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, one is a scumbag and one is, like, a very uptight.
Yeah.
You know, he's not even the cool Beverly Hills cop. He's the uptight Beverly Hills Cop. You know, he punches Axel in the stomach and you believe like, you know, I go, oh, it's like, this is an asshole. Like,
well, I love that scene too, because, the cop thing sort of overrides all that. Cause you know, he asks the police chief or not the chief, but the head of the department asks if he wants to press charges.
Yeah.
And Axel's like, fuck no, man. Like, like we're cops. Like I'm not going to do that.
Yeah. There's, I don't know.
Like, what's going on out here.
Yeah. There's something about this movie And because I'm a big cop movie fan, I love buddy cops. Here. I love action movies. And you know, talking about like, there's something about it that these are the unvarnished ones. Like the, you know, I put Midnight Run in there too. They're not cops, but you just, they feel like they're just more gritty. They have an indie feel to them. Like Lethal Weapon 1 is decidedly not versus all their sequels. Like they're, it's grittier. It feels like these are cops.
Dark movie.
Yeah. I mean, I love, and I know we're talking about relationships too, but I do love the action sequences in this. Like that opening action sequence with a big cigarette truck just careening around the streets of Detroit looks like the most dangerous stunt ever. And it feels more exciting in many ways than a Fast and Furious movie because, you know, there's no CGI. That's a real truck.
They demolished like 50 cars in that scene.
It, like, that was an era where, I mean, again, like the Blues Brothers era where you're just like destroying cars because you could.
Yeah.
And there's something so like tactile about just watching this, this, you know, the semi just going down, and cigarettes are flying and there's a real guy hanging on to that thing slamming.
Like, these days they would sit in front of a computer and map it all out and what could be real. And back then they were like, let's get 50 junkers and just fucking plow through them.
Yeah, just plow.
As violently as we can.
That's the opening of the movie and he's getting reprimanded the right way for that.
Too. Oh, yeah.
It's not, you know, it's bad news.
Yeah. And of course, Gil Hill is the chief. It's a bit of a trope as the grumpy police chief, as Inspector Todd. But he brought a profanity to it that just pushed it so far beyond that trope.
Well, here's the thing. I agree with you. And talking about what we've talked about before, like, where does the copy begin? Like, you know, because sort of like Die Hard, I can point to a million movies that do very similar things to Die Hard that become tropes because of Die Hard. So when you watch Die Hard now, you're like, oh, that's a trope. It's like, but did they start that trope?
Yeah.
You know, and like French Connection has like a surly kind of boss, you know. But you know, it's funny because our landscape now is littered with what worked. Like Beverly Hills Cop was the number one movie of like 1980, was it 84?
Yeah.
You know, so that gets ingrained. Everyone who's writing movies, seeing movies like, oh, well, we need that. We need that cop. We need that guy to ball out Schwarzenegger. We need that guy to, you know, and it becomes a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy. And sometimes it works. And I agree. He added a profanity. Like
it was just so over the top.
It's so crazy. And because he's a real guy, you also feel like it feels real. Cause he's not like, I'm taking your badge and gun. He's like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, you know, I don't know. There's something.
Victor Maitland, one of the great, 80s style.
Jürgen Prochnow, right?
Yeah. Baddies. He was amazing. So good in this movie. And the other scene that really got me, you know, Bronson Pinchot. Yeah. How do you pronounce that?
Pinchot, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. His scene as Serge was always like one of the funniest things as a kid to watch.
Yeah.
But watching it now, years later, for the first time in a while, I was like, man, Eddie Murphy is so generous as the straight guy in that scene.
Yes.
And he is sitting back and like he's the biggest, funniest movie star in the world or about to be. And he totally takes a back seat. And says, I'm going to totally be the straight guy in the scene.
And again, that, like, I feel like Eddie Murphy, it's that thing that you forget. It's like, he just lets someone hit a home run and he's enjoying it. And you see and he's getting to hit home runs every other scene. Like every scene, basically it feels like a cop movie that they were like, we can't really work on the script. We got to go into production in like 6 weeks. So they're like, all right. So now you go to the country club and you confront Victor Maitland's like, and then Eddie Murphy would be like, okay, great. So before I go in there, I'll do my little scene with the guy who owns the country club. And that will be the comedy. And it's almost like we should be writing cop movies like, or comedy cop movies like that. I think The Heat feels very much like that.
Yeah.
Like where the comedy is a part of the actual story instead of taking over. Cause it basically like every scene of this movie, he's doing all the cop things. If you took out, you could easily make an edit of this that has little to no jokes in it.
Yeah. I mean, that Serge scene doesn't need to be in there,
no,
but it's just fucking funny.
It's like, it's a sort of like a flourish on top of a scene. It's like, and it's, yeah, it, the movie functions. And I guess maybe that's what I'm getting at. Like the movie functions perfectly without any of those scenes.
Yeah.
But those scenes are so additive to your experience of the movie. Because you're like, oh, I'm laughing. Now all of a sudden, this guy's getting shot in the head and it's real.
Yeah,
you know, it's like, it feels real. And especially Taggart and Rosewood, which is, John Ashton and I'm forgetting it.
Judge Reinhold.
Yeah. They're clueless cops, but they're also not super cops. Like, that's the other thing. Like, no one's like, I mean, Axel Foley has a couple moves, but
yeah,
they're not doing anything too crazy. The movie culminates in a shootout at a guy's mansion. It's not.
Yeah, like a Scarface, like, yeah, shootout.
Yeah, it's not too big. I don't know. I like that.
Yeah, for sure. And even, not to harp too much on that Sarah scene, but as the straight man, he's still being very funny.
Oh, absolutely.
With his being small.
Yeah.
You know, going small with his reactions. It's very subtle, but I was just cracking up at Eddie Murphy in that scene.
I agree. One of my favorite scenes that's actually really funny in this movie as well, and it's a small performance, and I don't know the actor's name, but they go to the warehouse to kind of look at stuff. Mm-hmm. He encounters a security guard. He has a whole funny scene with that guy. But then they go to, like, the file room, and he's looking through the files.
Yeah.
And Eddie Murphy starts lashing out at this, like, one guy, a little bit of a nerdy guy. Uh-huh. And he's like, is that your Porsche out there? And he's like, you know, cause he, like, basically is like just chastising this guy. And then they go, okay, let him do his work. And he's doing his work. And the guy's like, no, sir, that's not my Porsche. I don't know whose Porsche that is. And it's such a funny, it's just a great little moment. And and the movie allows, and I think Martin Brest does this again in Midnight Run. Mm-hmm. Everyone gets like these like little things. Like Charles Grodin never been as great as he is in that film.
Yeah.
And I would argue, you know, Martin Brest, I want to say it in the best way possible, hurt Robert De Niro's career in making him so funny in Midnight Run. Because then people are like, well, he'll be funny in a lot of things.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, no, if you use him right, he will be your, like I think Meet the Parents, he's used perfectly.
Right.
And is great. Adventures of Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Yeah.
You know, sure. But like, and it's like, I think by showing off that side of De Niro, you're like, oh, he could be funny.
Yeah.
And then you misuse him.
Was that the first funny role he had, Midnight Run?
I feel like it has to be.
Yeah.
Right?
I think it probably was.
I feel like
was.
That was a big deal. Cause it wasn't even like he's, you know, Charles Grodin is definitely leading the comedy, but
it's all very kind of, deadpan.
Yeah.
Looking back, it's funny. Okay. Like Grodin and De Niro are literally one of the great comedy duos in film history to me because
Absolutely.
They were so great together in Midnight Run.
Yeah, they are. I'm just looking up right now, like where Robert De Niro is, because I'm pretty positive. It's
my friends and I, my friend Brett and I quote Midnight Run maybe more than any other film.
It is. I watch that movie at least, you know, twice a year, I feel like. It's such a great film. And, you know, and I love showing it to people because it's a movie that.
Yeah.
And I'll say this about Beverly Hills Cop. The same thing. I love showing this movie to people because their impression of what Eddie Murphy is.
Right.
Is so different. And then I remember showing this to my wife. She's like, wow, this is really good.
Uh-huh.
And it is. It's like it's a good performance. It's a good comedy performance. And it's a good action movie that actually has a pretty solid mystery, like the way that all these for whatever a cop movie is, uh-huh. like, you know, it's small. I think that's the thing I really like about it too. It's like, we're so used to, you know, oh, they're transporting nuclear weapons or this. It's like, no, it's an art dealer who's like smuggling coke in. It's a minor crime. It's a believable crime, even though they're getting.
And it never gets convoluted.
Right.
You know, it's a pretty simple story, which is what you want, because you want Eddie Murphy to come in there and have his pieces with the Banana Man.
Yes.
And just like these little things that are peppered throughout the movie.
Damon Wayans also in a little part there.
Yeah.
So
I think
funny.
That was his screen debut.
And also arguably, you know, this is a movie where, you know, there are some problematic elements too.
Sure.
But not as bad as not terrible. But that Damon Wayans caricature of a gay man is pretty intense. Yeah, this is the first time. I just go back to De Niro. He did a comedy because he was coming off of like Angel Heart and
a lot of heavy shit.
Yeah,
probably.
Once Upon a Time in America and the King of Comedy. Oh, King of Comedy is
in the darkest way possible. Yeah. That was a good movie.
But then after Midnight Run, you're getting into We're No Angels. And then, you know, and then it just kind of
started it all, didn't it?
Yeah. And then it's like Mad Dog and Glory, which is still a little straight. But it's interesting to watch his career because I watched all these movies. But yeah, it just started like there's certain these like little left field choices.
One of the other funny scenes, and again, like with the Sarge scene, like they definitely just pop these little things in there. Like Eddie Murphy could have gone to the restaurant to confront Victor Maitland and just gone straight in there. But yeah. No, he goes in there with the, you know, the Capricorn, herpes simplex 10.
Yeah, exactly.
And it just like, it makes the whole thing better.
Well, just again, it's just showing how you can be additive without derailing a movie. And I think there's like, there's a great thing for, you know, to me, my number one movie in this like genre of what I love and try to aspire to, and this may have been the movie I've said, but I feel like I talk about it so many times, is Ghostbusters. Like Ghostbusters to me. Yeah, because Ghostbusters to me is a kind of a perfect movie in the sense that it works fully as like a sci-fi film that has like really funny comedy beats. Like, mm-hmm. you know, that are not distracting from the plot or not derailing the plot, not selling out your characters for the plot. And if it was so easy to do, we'd have a million of them. And we don't have a million Beverly Hills Cops. We don't have a million Ghostbusters. It's every now and then you get this thing, you're like, oh, that's so good. Like, and I think like The Heat is the closest I've seen lately that kind of is a funny cop movie. But, you know, there's still big things in it. But Ghostbusters is arguably, people try so many times to capture what that is. But I think it's like partly is like keeping it small. But mm-hmm. I think we're in an era where everything has to be big. Like you mm-hmm. would never be able to make this movie now. This is an independent movie, Beverly Hills Cop, at this point. Like, you know, it because it would have there would have to be a house exploding, a freeway chase. Like you can't just get away with throwing a guy through a plate glass window. And it's a dialogue based movie.
Which was funny in itself, actually. Yeah, that's how they get rid of him.
Yeah, he goes like, throw myself through a plate glass window. But yeah, I do think that the movie, like, I mean, and I think one of the seminal scenes is, we talked about before, like the idea of race and like mm-hmm. the idea that, you know, they are racially profiling him.
Yeah.
And then he uses race against them. And that's constantly the battle of the movie. Uh-huh. It's like, you know, he's trying to con a room at the Beverly Hills Hotel.
For $235 a night, which is funny now.
When you hear that, you're like, whoa. So he's trying to get in there and he uses race against them. And then the town is using race against him to kind of minimize him. And everywhere he goes,
he works it to his advantage when he can.
Yeah. It's status. It's like playing these status things. And it's one of those movies, and I always try to find these movies, whether it's Galaxy Quest, whether it's Midnight Run, Beverly Hills Cop, these movies that are a little bit lower on the scale of, like, they're not like...
Of reverence?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean,
people aren't sitting around, like we talk about Platoon, it's like, you're not putting them in the conversation of the greatest comedies of all time or the greatest action movies of all time, but there are great examples of these great movies that so work and are so fulfilling. I mean, you just watched it, but you said the other night.
Yeah.
Was it like, did you enjoy your experience in watching it? Was it like a fun?
I had a blast. And it was, I think one of the reasons some of these movies aren't included like that is it's so 80s.
Right.
And it's so easy to write it off for that reason if you don't really sit down and watch it.
Right.
If you think like you hear fucking Neutron Dance.
Right.
And The Heat is On and all these. And it's actually kind of funny. It was a great time to be like a middle-aged black woman as a performer, because I forgot, like, there were so many, there was just like a string of hits.
Oh, that, like, that soundtrack I owned and played so many times and still even have it as like a Spotify playlist on my phone. It's,
yeah,
it's great. And like, you know what I love about it too? It's 80s without being overtly 80s. Like, there's a scene where he's driving through Beverly Hills and he looks at this guy dressed as like basically Michael Jackson in Thriller and is like laughing at it because, like, it's almost like saying, like, that's how certain people are living the 80s. But when you look at Detroit, it's just jeans and t-shirts or, you know, it's like they're not like throwing 80s shit in there. It's like the music and everything feels like that. But it just feels more along the lines of like 70s aesthetic in an 80s movie, but with all the 80s trappings of those, you know, like there's a million songs in it at every given point. And by the way, speaking of the best instrumental song of all time, the Axel F theme.
Can't go without mentioning the great Herbie Hancock.
It's Harold Faltmire.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
I think I just wrote down Herbie Hancock because I misremembered.
I mean, yeah, Harold Faltmire. Yeah.
Right.
And it's a great.
That was a top 10 hit, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And it's come back.
I remember Casey Kasem listening to that on Sundays.
Oh, it was a huge hit and it's great. And I've been told that the best when you have an earworm, like when you have a song you can't get out of your head, just hum that song and it will knock it out.
I've always heard Ring of Fire by Johnny Cash.
Oh, so that's great. All right. So there we go. But there's something crazy about that, because that song came back only a handful of years ago for like Disco Frog. It was a EMD kind of song.
Oh, really?
There's a zillion Axel F like tripped out crazy versions that became number one as well. I think it's Crazy Frog's Axel F became number one for a little
bit. So funny.
Yeah.
It's an iconic,
a lot of here to like keyboard. a lot here to like. And then it's funny to me, I'm always saying like, I love when you watch the sequels, because that's when you start to like, all right, they drive a little bit into different directions.
And
I still love the sequel. I love it.
Me too.
And the sequel has a very like, it's Dom Bruckheimer and
Simpson and Bruckheimer.
So it has that kind of energy behind it. And it's the beginning of that energy, which is kind of like that movie kind of leads to a movie like The Rock. And then The Rock leads to a movie like Transformer. You know, it's like, you know, it's the beginning step of that. So you still are like, I mean, look, they're running around with a cement truck there and it's a great sequence too. But, you know, it's like they're playing, you know, they're going to, like the perfect example of the difference between one and two is they go to the Playboy Mansion and two. And it's like, okay, now that like, sure. And it's a funny sequence and he's talking to Hugh Hefner, but it's like, okay. Yeah. Like, and I love it. I'm just saying, if I'm looking at it from a critical point of view,
yeah,
it's like, that's where they kind of like edged that jumping of the shark. And then when you go to number three, it's like, well, they forgot everything that was good.
Right.
And Eddie Murphy even feels like he forgot everything that was good in that movie. Yeah. It's like Hector Elizondo, no offense, is in there now. And it's like, what the fuck am I watching? And I think one of the reasons what's so good is like Ronnie Cox.
Oh man, he's so great.
Just an amazing guy. I got to direct him. I directed an episode of Children's Hospital with Ronnie Cox, and it was everything that I had to hold back everything just because I want to talk to him about all of this stuff. And he's a great guy who will tell those stories.
And Deliverance. I mean, my God.
Deliverance, RoboCop, Beverly Hills Cop.
RoboCop. Yeah, of course.
He's great.
At the end of the day, though, what I realized watching it now in my middle age, like this is a movie about friendships, really.
Yeah.
Whether it's Mikey and Jenny or Taggart and Rosewood, like they have a very sweet, they end up in a very sweet place as three like legit pals who you feel like would do anything to help each other at that point.
I think one of the things that I love about Beverly Hills Cop 2, it's a small little detail, is the picture of them fishing. It's on Axel's like the camera's panning across Ronnie Cox's office.
Uh-huh.
And it's just sort of like, and you see like, oh, in the interim between these two movies, they all went fishing. They went on a fishing trip together.
I don't think I ever noticed that. That's great.
And I love it. So like, to me, by the way, I had a pitch always, I mean, no one is asking, but my whole pitch for Beverly Hills Cop 4, I always thought, I got it. And my pitch was this, at least to get into it. They're on one of their fishing trips.
Uh-huh.
And again, this also has to take, I'm not taking in to accord how old they all are now. But they're all on a fishing trip, but they're off the coast of Miami.
Uh-huh.
And they see something happening out in the water while they're in there. And they go back to Miami. And so you take it out of Beverly Hills and you go to Miami and they go to Miami and they're now both fish out of water there.
Yeah.
There's a Beverly Hills cop and hopefully Axel Foley is still from Detroit.
Uh-huh.
And then you bring them and you bring them there to just another culture that would be interesting when you put them both as fish out of water. And I think that that's a certain point that always felt like, oh, that would be really cool to see.
A nice way to finish it off.
Yeah.
Have you actually pitched that?
No, I wish I could. I don't know who I feel like the people that they're listening to pitches for. I got to I snake so much Beverly Hills Cop stuff because I just love it. So I've gotten to read like Beverly Hills Cop scripts that were optioned and were terrible. Like, but I don't know if they're placeholders either. I don't know if it's like, well, this will be funny because of this. But Beverly Hills Cop 3 just fucked it all up because they kill Gil Hill. Like, they take away Paul Reiser. Like, you wreck the things that you want to see. And the thing that I love about Paul Reiser and Gil Hill and the Detroit stuff is that they are – you could check in on them. And they're, they're not crucial, but they are there's something really fun about those characters.
I mean, has there ever been a third movie in a franchise that was very good? That's a tough
one. No, I guess you're right.
That's a tough one.
I'm sure that someone will, write into us and tell us, but wait.
Yeah.
And I think it's a rant. It's the only time you ever get that is like in an X-Men First Class, when Matthew Vaughn is. But that's not a third. That's a new director doing a reboot.
Yeah.
Even when I've been working on Galaxy Quest for TV, you know, my big thing with that has been, and, you know, for better or for worse, and dealing with a lot of different people and mm-hmm. why they think Alex Quest works is like, we just can't do the same thing. Mm-hmm. You have to create something new, because if you don't, you're just going to spin out.
Yeah.
You can't, you know, it's like this tough line of, you know, that's why I think Aliens is a great sequel. I love yeah. Aliens. It's not, it's of the same ilk as Alien, mm-hmm. but it's not I wouldn't even consider it's a spiritual sequel. It's
yeah.
like, you know, it's, and that's how I think we should be making movies. Like, you don't right. have to be like, let's get him back to Beverly Hills and there's right. another thing and there's another, you know, it's like.
That's the worst kind of sequeling, is just literally recycling the same jokes in a yeah, different way.
Because it's like, well, what you want to see is these characters back, but you don't want to see the same. It's a fine line. I don't know what are the best sequels? I mean, there's only a handful, right?
Yeah, not many.
Yeah, it's like they all just fizzle hard.
Yeah. All right, we finished with a couple of segments. You feel good about Beverly Hills Cop?
Yeah, feel good.
All right. What Ebert said, and then five questions. I always try and see what Roger Ebert said about some of these films.
This movie is a complete disappointment.
He gave this one 2.5 stars.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so he was a little off the mark here to me. He says, when Murphy tries to move against Maitland, he comes up against the Beverly Hills Cops, including an Abbott and Costello team, supplies unnecessary pratfalls, successfully undermining the credibility of any police scene that threatens to work. But wait a minute, what's this movie about anyway? Is it a comedy or an action picture? It's both. Audiences may expect a comedy, but the closing shootout scene is inspired by the machine gun massacre at the end of Scarface, and the whole business with the cocaine is so very, very tired that when we see the boss and his henchmen in the warehouse, we feel like we switched to another movie, maybe a dozen other movies. So
interesting.
I don't buy that.
I think the thing that we like about it is that it does, I think, do tonal switches. And mm-hmm. it's something that I think good films can, I think one of the most exciting things is like those changes of tone. Like, can you pull that off? Can you go there and can you go back? And I think it's something that probably now if you watch it, you'd be like, oh, this is in.
Yeah. It might, I don't think it happened a lot then.
We find a lot on Unspooled. Some of the biggest reviewers that you know ripping on these films.
Yeah.
And pretty much all of them, not to say this is like one of the best films of all time, but whenever these movies are doing something big, whether mm-hmm. it's 2001, whether it's Citizen Kane, whether it's, you know, the only ones that have not gotten bad reviews really have been Swing Time and Ben-Hur, which is funny because arguably they're the most palatable.
Right.
But when you're making something that's trying to do something different that you had not seen, people often come at them and like, no, it's not my perspective. And and again, talking to this guy who I know who wrote and directed Hotel Artemis, it's interesting because they're billing it as John Wick. And people are coming, and some of the reviews I read, they're like, well, it's not John Wick. It's like, well, it's not supposed to be John Wick.
Right.
It's more Barton Fink meets Repo Man.
Right.
But if you go in with this preconceived notion, it's a very interesting thing that you don't change it by what you're watching. It's like, well, can't you have a movie that switches tone? Does it have to be all action? Does it have to be all comedy? Can you go in and out of both? I don't know. I think
which is interesting because I thought 48 Hours did that well.
48 Hours is great, and 48 Hours is kind of the testing ground for this because it's like it is less comedic. Remembrance of it, but like you get that bar scene. Like that bar scene is a great thing, and Eddie Murphy is dancing around, but it's like that's a pretty brutal end scene too. That's great, I love that. Beautifully shot.
All right, five questions with Paul Scheer. What's the first movie you remember seeing in the theater?
Well, I have tell me if this counts. Drive-in movie, The Jerk. I remember my parents sneaking me into a drive-in movie and seeing The Jerk from underneath the covers and probably falling asleep in the middle of it.
Yeah, I saw Blazing Saddles that way when I was like 4.
Oh, wow. So fun. Yeah. It's like, your parents went to go see a movie and they're like, well, he can sleep in the back.
Yeah, exactly.
I've thought that a few times with my kids.
First R-rated movie.
Hmm.
Does that stand out?
You know, I'll tell you that I believe if it wasn't Beverly Hills Cop, the one that I felt most scandalous in watching is Risky Business.
Yeah.
Risky Business was like we convinced my friend's mom to rent it for us. And she just saw like a kid with like a Lamborghini or with a Porsche on the front. So she didn't understand that this is a movie about a guy like hiring a prostitute.
Yeah.
And that was like, whoa, sexy. Yeah. What is this? This is crazy. And I recently rewatched it. It's a good movie.
It is a good movie.
You know, but that was like, whoa, sex. Like, it just felt like something big.
Yeah, that subway scene. I mean, that's hot stuff.
Yeah, very much.
Rebecca De Mornay, man.
She
a lot of teenage boys in the 80s.
Oh, absolutely. It's so crazy.
Yeah. Will you walk out of a bad movie? Do you remember doing so?
Yeah, I contemplated walking out of Last Action Hero when I saw it. I want to watch it again. I want to revisit it because
that wasn't a very good movie.
Yeah, right. It felt like it was trying to be one thing. Mm-hmm. Shane Black, huge fan of Shane Black, love Shane Black. But that was like his attempt at kind of doing like a meta commentary on the angry police chief captain or all this. And I remember like sitting there and going, well, I should leave. I don't know. And I got myself caught up in stuff like that, like Major League 3, mm-hmm. also like in the theater.
Third movie again.
I know, third movie. Major League 1, great movie too.
Agreed.
But I'm trying to think if I've walked out. Oh, well, yes. And I've talked about this before, but I, again, a drive-in, drove out of a drive-in during Lady in the Water. A double screening of Lady in the Water and Beer Fest. And we just took off.
Uh-huh. That's a commitment to when you're driving out.
Oh, yeah. That was like just watching everyone stare at us as we pull out of there.
Sorry. Yeah. Number four, I tailored to the guest. So I'm going to go with what classic comedy do you wish you could have been in? And maybe even character.
Well, I love Ghostbusters. I mean, Ghostbusters to me is great. Mm-hmm. But just because we talked about that a little bit, maybe I'll say, it's a good question. Like, what are the, It's funny because I feel like in my grand scheme, I'll say this. Just because I've talked about Ghostbusters and I talk about it all the time, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Yeah.
And I would love to have been either one of those characters, really. It's a great movie. It's a great underappreciated film. Again, another movie hard to pull off. Like those John Hughes movies.
Yeah.
Wow. They are often copied and very rarely achieved.
Yeah.
That Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, I would give me either one. And I feel like I could do a take on either version. I mean, and no offense to those two guys, because John Candy and Steve Martin are like kind of at the top of their game. And 100%.
Such a great movie.
Yeah.
And then finally, Movie Going 101. What's your theater ritual? Where do you sit? What do you eat?
Oh, okay. For me, I am, I've become a middle. Well, I'll tell you, when I'm by myself, it's a couple things. So
yeah, I like this.
So it depends on when I'm seeing the movie. If I'm seeing the movie and I know it's going to be packed, I am picking an aisle. I like being on the aisle. I like the freedom of the aisle. Not that I use it, but I just like, I like being there. When I know I'm going to go see a movie during the middle of the day, I am going mid. Uh-huh. Like, so that's what I like. I've been experimenting with, way back last row.
Oh.
I like that as well. That's a nice place to kind of be. Back row, right-hand corner. And
experimenting.
And,
I like it.
Yeah, because it's sort of like, I'm like, oh, well, middle is where everyone wants to sit.
Right.
But back is actually really nice. I feel like you get like a real, I saw Last Jedi back corner and it was great. It just felt like I was like, I don't know. It just felt like it was, I just liked that experience of like, I could take it all in.
It depends on the screen, sometimes with the stadium seating, the back row, you're like kind of at the top of the screen, which I don't love.
Yeah, no. And it's all theater dependent. Snack wise, if, ideal, I'm going with Twizzlers, not Red Vines, Twizzlers, because I'm more East Coast than West Coast. And I'm going to take some peanut or regular M&Ms, put them in my popcorn.
That's a familiar move.
Yeah. I love that. And then, you know, I feel like it's a movie, so I'll treat myself to like a, whether it's Mr. Pibb or Dr. Pepper, kind
Chunky
of
soda.
Like kind of a cherry Coke. Now that they got those freestyle machines, I mean, my life is great, you know, but,
what do you mix it up?
Well, what I really do right now, cause I feel like it's bad to drink that much sugar. I will give myself pretty much more than 3/4 worth of like carbonated water and then just throw in a little bit of orange Fanta just to kind of top it off. And that's right. my go-to. But yeah, that's my, my thing. And lately I have two kids. So going to see movies is a tricky proposition for my wife and I, because we are, it's like,
I'm with you.
It's not about getting the kids. It's about getting the kids down, but it's also like when you can get out of the house. And if you get, and then we need to hit that 7:30 movie, because the 10:30 movies are, it's like, it's hard. So, I've been seeing a lot of movies during the day and I love it.
It's
love
the best.
Sneaking out for 2 hours. And I finally enjoy movies more now too.
Yeah.
That way. Cause I'm just sort of like fully engaged in my movie going experience.
Yeah. An Arclight midday matinee is,
yeah,
like there's some serious film lovers in those rooms.
Oh, I love it. And I will recommend, for you who I imagine you, how many kids do you have?
I got 1 3-year-old daughter.
Okay, great. So I like this thing out here in LA. It's called the IPIC Theater. It is a small theater. Mm-hmm. So each theater probably has less than 40 seats. Mm-hmm. And they have a full service bar and kind of restaurant. But the way the restaurant works is it's kind of like a step up from the Alamo Drafthouse. You are in these giant, relaxing, like lazy boys. Uh-huh. They can kind of go back and you really can get comfortable in them. And they have a table built in, and all the food they deliver, and it's good food made by good chefs, are, you don't need a fork and knife.
Yeah.
So it's all handheld food, all kind of like, even if it's the nachos, they're all individual. And so you can kind of have a date night where you have dinner, drinks, and a movie all in one. And I said to my wife, we've never had a bad movie experience ever. We've seen so many, really, without saying their names, terrible movies there. And I've left and I'm like, it was a great time.
Right.
Yeah.
It's good stuff.
So yeah, that's my parenting tip.
All right. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you so much.
It was a lot of fun.
It's so much fun. Thanks so much.
All right, everybody. Another one in the can. That was a lot of fun. Paul is, he's a very good conversationalist, and that was a lot of fun. I've never met him before, but we got along great, and he's very easy to talk to, and it was fun talking Beverly Hills Cop and hearing all those great stories about the early days of UCB and just that talented group of people that he came up with. And check out Unspooled. Check out How Did This Get Made? Two great, great other movie podcasts that Paul does. And maybe, who knows, maybe he'll ask me to be on one of them one day. I can only hope. You can follow him on Twitter at Paul Scheer, PaulScheer. And check out The League. Check out Human Giant. Definitely check out Children's Hospital. All great Paul Scheer vehicles. All right, so that's it for this week, everyone. Thanks for joining us. And until next time, as the sun sets slowly in the west, I bid you a fine farewell. Movie Crush is produced, engineered, edited, and soundtracked by Noel Brown and Ramsey Yunt at How Stuff Works Studios, Ponce City Market, Atlanta, Georgia.